Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. We have an update on our series about rental evictions during the pandemic. The moratorium on evicting people who have fallen behind on rent had been set to expire at the end of January. On his first afternoon in office, President Biden signed an executive order extending the federal eviction moratorium until at least March 31st, and Governor Beshear says Kentucky will as well.
Yes, we will extend the eviction moratorium once that is official through the federal government. We did that the last time. We will do it this time.
It's important that renters keep in mind the advice we heard from EKU professor and attorney James Pennington.
A moratorium is an authorized postponement. So I think it's important for listeners to know that this isn't a cancellation of past due rent.
And as we heard from Ray Sexton, director of the Lexington Human Rights Commission.
People are encouraged to sit down and work it out and come up with a payment plan and get to it very quickly. Without that, you may have people going longer without even having any ability to pay rent.
With more than 40% of Kentucky rental households at risk of eviction, we're following developments and we'll keep you informed. The book Silas House, Exploring an Appalachian Writer's Work, will be publishing soon. And for a peek inside its pages, we turn to Sylvia Sherbet, the book's editor. Dr. Sherbet is a professor of English and director of the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Sylvia, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Oh, well, very fine. I'm happy to be here.
And out of the gate, broad question, but what is this book about? What does it contain?
Well, this book, you know, we thought about so many of the great, wonderful, talented Appalachian writers in the region. But, you know, something unique about Silas House is that his work is so wonderfully Appalachian, but he also transcends the region. So we really wanted to, we hope we'll do this for other writers, but we wanted to start with a writer that was not only reflective of the cultural attitudes that we have in Appalachia, but also transcends the area and can give us, you know, just start with the very best. And Silas, as young as he is, he has just really given us books and such an array of different kinds of writing that does transcend the region.
What statement is being made about a writer when somebody goes to this trouble, the trouble of compiling a book of reviews of their works?
Well, it means that a writer has really made his mark upon the critical world and academia and also a popular readership. And Silas has definitely done that. I hope that the book that we have put together, and we've tried to cover all of the areas of Silas's just incredible range of talent. So he's not just a novelist, but he does many, many things. And we think that we've captured that in this book. And that was what we wanted to do with such a writer as Silas House.
Some argue that knowledge of a writer's life is just a distraction from what really matters, that writer's work. But how important is it to know something about the person who committed the words to page?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of work with writers like Ron Rash, and Ron tends to, because his work transcends the region as well, he tends to repeat a wonderful idea, I think, is that if you look at one particular place in time and in a region and you do it really, really well, you can uncover and write about the whole of human nature. And I think that, you know, that was one of the reasons we chose to write about Silas House, that, you know, his work is just immensely representative of what we all are, not only in Appalachia, but outside of Appalachia.
You note that the fiction writer, above much else, is the purveyor of empathy. Talk to us about this. Does Silas House succeed in awakening our empathy?
Oh, I think that he does. You know, a lot of these ideas, I think, come from Shelley and being a teacher. You know, Shelley, the poet Shelley, came to the conclusion that if he wanted to change the world, he couldn't foment revolution on the street sides of Ireland or wherever he was trying to, you know, do some good work. But he thought that, first of all, you have to change the hearts of men and women. And you do that by creating empathy. So empathy is Shelley says, is the real legislator of mores and moral fiber and this kind of thing. So Silas has this quality. I mean, he is not per se a polemical writer, a writer that says, oh, I'm going to write thus and such to change attitudes about thus and such. He gives us great stories that engage us, but these stories always have a way of helping us to empathize with people that we might have considered as other, that we might have stereotyped in another setting. And Silas gives us the opportunity to take another look at that person and look at all of ourselves as human beings rather than members of different cliques and groups and tribes.
You touched on this earlier. While Silas's work is situated in the hills and hollows of Appalachia, you note that it really transcends Appalachia. How does it do that?
It does that. Yes, it does. I think that he chooses themes, he chooses ideas, what we just talked about a moment ago. He helps us to empathize and identify with others that we would not normally have wanted to do that. And I think that that particularly is a really great quality in this day and age, a time when we are all so devoted to our different tribes. So Silas helps us to transcend that, to get out of that particular smothering attitude that we have about other people and in our own lives. And he helps us to look at the world in a little bit broader way. And the stories, I think, as well as his nonfiction writing, helps us to do that.
Well, this is a book of reviews of Silas House's work. Can you give us a sense of that? How many contributions are there, for example?
What we tried to do, we first of all put out a call for people who wanted to contribute to this book, and we explained that we wanted to write about Silas House and show all the different facets of House's work. What we finally decided to do, we began to see that if we took a genre approach, we could touch on all of these many aspects and facets of Silas House and really get a full picture of what he attempts to do, because he's just so much more than just a writer of fiction, a writer of stories. So, you know, we narrowed down the particular works that we were going to include, and we, for example, we wanted to include works by Adam Booth and Natalie Seipolt, who take a look at Silas and his addressing communities that have been othered. So one chapter deals with queerness, that's an old-fashioned Appalachian word, and queer characters in Silas House, and that doesn't necessarily mean queer, but it also can mean that. Another, Natalie Seipolt, wrote a chapter on Silas's plays, and she deals with diversity issues as well. We have a young woman whose name, a young scholar whose name is Jacqueline Yon, and she writes about Silas's young adult fiction. It's really, really important, particularly introducing to Appalachian students, both white and those students that are other in other diverse groups, to take a look at the diversity that you have in Appalachian literature. And they don't normally always get that in high school and in middle school, but Silas's work, he has young adult literature that tries to accomplish that. So that is really exciting. We also had Marianne Worthington, a scholar who wanted to write about Silas House as a journalist and an activist. Jennifer Riddles wanted to write about the music that you find in Silas House's work, both his fiction and his writing about music. And then we wanted to also have a poet. We've got just an absolutely first-rate poet, Maurice Manning, who is writing about the lyricism and the use of metaphor in Silas House's work. But it was really Denise Giardina that kind of pulls everything together in the foreword of the book. She knows Silas really, really well. She knows his work well. And so she sort of sets the tone for this book in that foreword as she introduces all of this to us.
These would seem to be expressions of that transcendence that we were talking about.
On one of the opening pages, they do have this quote that comes from Silas House's last book, Southernmost, and it's a quote that goes like this: "But there is where the God of his understanding lives, not just in the goodness, not in the badness, but in the shimmering knot of the two, the shimmering knot of the two." So there is this controlling image that we tried to keep to throughout the book, this idea that Silas House, what he tries to do in his stories is what William Blake called investigate the underpinnings of the universe. Blake called it the fearful symmetry. But it's this idea that the God, the universe, is really not something that is simplistically good, horribly bad, but the God of the universe is a combination of all aspects of that, of the world that God has created. And so the shimmering knot, this image that you find at the very end of Southernmost, it's a beautiful, beautiful scene where Asher, the preacher who has kidnapped his own son, and he's trying to get rid of his own demons. He had rejected a brother who was gay, and now that he is championing people who have been othered, he's been outcast by his community and thrown out of his church, and then they tried to take his son away from him. So he kidnaps his son, and he knows that's not a good thing, but he kidnaps his son, and he travels down to Florida, the very tip end of Florida, Key West, and there he locates his brother, and he's just really trying to have a determination about, you know, what is at the heart of the universe? Why is there so much argumentation, so much evil in the world, and so much good at the same time? And why are the hearts of human beings not necessarily good, not necessarily all bad, but kind of a mixture of the two? So there is this moment where his son is playing in the water at Key West. And if you've ever been to Key West, you know how the water just shimmers as the sun is going down. And he looks at the sparkling water and his son playing in the water and all of the people that are in the water, and they kind of blend together. And he makes this comment, "But there is where the God of my understanding lives, not just in the goodness, not in the badness, but in the shimmering knot of the two." So that is a really sophisticated way to look at moral ethics, goodness, badness. I think that you find this kind of attitude in the work of Denise Giardina. She doesn't give us simplistic moral attitudes, but she gives us a kind of deeper understanding of where the world is. And that really is at the heart and soul of how Silas House really transcends the region, and how he gives us something that helps us to understand, you know, where we are at this moment in time in a very, very unsettling world.
Well, Sylvia, we have about 90 seconds left, and I wanted to be sure to ask you about the experience of immersing yourself in these works. What have you carried away from this experience?
Well, I have, we started years and years ago when Silas really was just coming up in the world, inviting Silas to be our Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence. And so, and he was the first writer that we used, and he was a Common Read writer for West Virginia as well. And so in the process of all of that, what we try to do and what I try to do is the leader of this endeavor is to really go deeply into the writers works and explore those works. And I did do that. And certainly it's not the same. The essay, the first essay in the collection is called The Stories of Silas House, The Scent of Words, The Scent of Words, Looking at Appalachia and the World from the Inside Out. So that's kind of a variation of that essay. It's vastly changed because Silas has written so much more since I originally wrote that essay. So the essay is very different, but it's in immersing myself in the work of Silas House and the words of Silas House. Silas has participated in our NEH Summer Institutes and our Teacher Institutes. He's such a giving person about his time. He wants people to understand his work, and so he's always willing to, he's no prima donna, he's always willing to come and talk with teachers, with students. And I've just really gotten to know him over the years in a very wonderful way, and I have a lot of admiration for his work, having studied his work so deeply.
And when and where will the book be available?
The book is coming out in June. It will be on bookshelves. It's already on Amazon. You can order the book. You pre-order the book from Amazon, and you'll be one of the first ones to get it.
Sylvia Sherbert is a professor of English and director of the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And she is editor of the forthcoming book, Silas House, Exploring the Appalachian Writer's Work. Thanks, Sylvia.
My pleasure.
Around the time that I began talking with Sylvia Sherbert about discussing the Silas House book, I heard about another artist from the region who now lives in Nashville. And Tiffany Williams is on the line with us right now. Hi, Tiffany.
Hey, Tom.
So, Tiffany, a mutual friend of ours, my WEKU colleague, Jean Marie Hibbard, told me about you and sent me a link to an interview with you on the Change 7 website. So I'm reading it, I'm enjoying every word of it, and I come to the bottom of the page, and there is a photo, and I instantly recognize Dwayne Lundy, the Lexington producer, the sound engineer, musician also, who has brought to life a number of projects that I've been involved in, as well as many others here in the area. And then I read on that Dwayne is working with you on an EP in collaboration with Silas House, Small World. And this was on New Year's Saturday, so I text Dwayne, thinking I might or might not catch him, and it turns out that you're right there at that moment in Dwayne's studio.
I was going to say I was there, and he told me about it,
So, I asked him to mention it to you, that I'd like to talk to you, and here we are. So, Tiffany, your wonderful voice has been filling our house here today, and so to be fair to our listener, I want to give them a sense of Tiffany Williams. You mind if I play just a little bit of one of your songs, maybe the first verse?
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
All right. Here's the first verse of Ticket to the Moon.
The man I wanted to love bought a ticket to the moon. He kissed my hand and he said, I'll be back soon, I'll be back soon. Waiting breaks your heart, and hoping leaves you hard in love. I know it does.
So, Tiffany, it's wonderful. And I'm wondering, is that all you, or did you have some other collaborators on that track?
Well, that track I actually started on my own, and then I finished it with a duo in Nashville called My One and Only. Super talented. They tour across the country in powerhouse vocals and great songs. I'm the vocal on it, and the production is Ben Wilson, who is a member of My One and Only, and then his wife Cassie Wilson is the other writer on it. But yeah, no, it was definitely a collaboration that kind of came together in quarantine, and I started on my own and reached out to them to help me finish it.
So our listeners can get a sense of you, Tiffany. I know that you now live and work in Nashville, but where's home?
Home is McRoberts, Kentucky in Letcher County. And my people have been there. They were there before some of them were there before the coal company came. And in 1912 was when Consolidated came. But yeah, McRoberts, Letcher County, Eastern Kentucky. I've got a lot of people from Southwestern Virginia too. I think it'll always be my home no matter where I am.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true with every Kentuckian who is not in Kentucky. Was for me for many years. So you mentioned that you have an EP in the works about to come out. Is that the same project that you're working in collaboration with Silas House?
No. So the EP comes out in February. It's all set to go. And there's four songs on it. Two of them are songs that have already been released as singles. The LP is what I'm working on. The LP, the longer album, it's actually going to be 10 tracks instead of, you know, the EP's four. I've never released a full album before. My only other album is a 5-song EP that came out in early 2019. But yeah, so Dwayne and I are working on the LP, and that's the one that Silas came in on, accompanying me on a duet that I wrote, years ago. But when I needed a demo of it, I went to him to see if he would sing on it with me, so then I could take it to a publisher here in Nashville. And so we kind of always thought of that as our song. I'll speak for him. But it was kind of like the song that we do together. And so, you know, it kind of felt like his voice needed to be on it because it associated that song with him so much. But the other thing too is his voice is home for several reasons. First of all, because, you know, we talk the same. Mm-hmm. and also because I found my writing voice and my singing voice at LMU's Mountain Heritage Literary Festival and the Appalachian Writers Workshop in Hindman. And so both of those places was, you know, where I got to know Silas. And so he's been my dear friend for a decade. But I think just the fact that, you know, I would sing in the after hours at those workshops and he would sing, and I just loved hearing him. And so many special events I've been to, his voice has been attached to it. And just the most beautiful tone too. I love his tone. I'm just so grateful to have him on that track because it's special because he's on it.
The release date for the LP, when's that going to be?
Well, it's slated for August 20th. However, you know, things change and I'm kind of waiting. I think all musicians are kind of waiting to see how everything lands. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping for late August, but we shall see.
Well, I almost hate to ask you this next question because of the burden of expectation that it can place on the creative process, but I'm going to ask it anyway, if you don't mind. And that is, how much of this collaboration with Silas is about a melding of Eastern Kentucky music and literature? And of course, he represents the literature side of it. Mm-hmm. And how much is the representation of the region by a collaboration between a coal miner's daughter, granddaughter, great-granddaughter, that's you, with another deeply rooted Eastern Kentuckian?
Well, I think the latter is probably more of the reason that I wanted him on there, because to me, it feels like a Kentucky album just because, you know, I know that Dwayne's worked with a lot of Kentucky artists, but I did not know about him and I didn't find out about him through any of our mutual friends at all. It was, I was looking for a sound I wanted. And so I was going through tracks on Spotify and I came across a Joe Pug album and I looked up the producer and there was Dwayne, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that wasn't intentional, but I feel like sometimes the stars align and then, you know, it kind of brings you to the place that you were meant to be. So yeah, it feels like a quintessentially Kentucky album with, you know, I'm recording it in Lexington, even though I live in the, you know, in Nashville, I could, you know, walk down the road and go to somebody's home studio. And so, yeah, I was conscious of the fact that I want Silas on it because Silas is such a symbol of Kentucky. He speaks for us in so many different, you know, through so many different media and represents us so well. I feel like we're really fortunate to have him. As I said before, with his voice, like, it's kind of like one of the symbols of home. And so when it was coming together as, and I felt like it was a Kentucky album, it just made sense to have him on there. I know a lot of singers in Kentucky. I'm fortunate to know a great group of people up there, but he was the first person I thought of and the first person I asked because I love his voice and it's a Kentucky album and, you know, he was the perfect fit.
Well, you have a terrific voice, Tiffany, and I can't wait to hear the two of these together. It's just going to be magical, I'm pretty sure. We've been on the line to Nashville with singer-songwriter and recording artist Tiffany Williams. Thanks so much, Tiffany.
Thank you.
And guess whose ears have been burning?
Howdy, Tom. This is Silas House.
He will join us in just a moment, and we'll hear from another well-known Kentucky writer, Frank X. Walker. He talks with Eastern Standard contributor Tom Eblen about his observations as a poet and author of life at home during the pandemic.
To use my brother's language, to be trapped in the same house with somebody.
Yeah.
But still find out that you love them, you know, dearly, is a great reward.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
You can listen to previous editions of Eastern Standard online at eswku.org. Navigate to our archive tab and take a deep dive into our programs. Curious about something? Have a topic to suggest for our consideration? You can email your idea to es@eku.edu. You can take Eastern Standard with you wherever you go with the WEKU mobile app. Easy to find in your app store. Just search for WEKU. You can take Eastern Standard with you wherever you go with the WEKU mobile app. Easy to find in your app store. Just search for WEKU. And now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Earlier in the hour, we heard from Sylvia Sherbet, editor of a forthcoming book of critical reviews of the works of the celebrated Kentucky author Silas House. And we heard from singer-songwriter Tiffany Williams about her collaboration with House in a duet for her new album being released later this year. Joining us now is the man himself. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Silas House.
Well, thanks for having me.
So not many of us have books published about our work, and it's hard enough to get the work done, much less worry about what your peers think of what you're doing. So I'm wondering, what's it like for you, Silas, as an author, to have your work subjected to a critical lens by this variety of established and rising scholars?
Well, I'm just honored to be talked about in any way that I can be. I'm just glad that my work is being read and taken seriously. You know, I have read some of these because they have been published in years past, and for them to be written by such fine academics and thinkers is a real honor.
Has it been a little nerve-wracking to kind of wait for this book to come out, even though you've read a few of them? You haven't read all of them.
Well, I don't know if nerve-wracking is. I have anticipated. Yeah, I'm anxious to read what all is in there. Mm-hmm. But, however, I'm not. I don't usually read a lot of stuff that is written about my work. I think it's, you know, when I'm writing, I don't write for a particular critic or an audience or anything like that. I'm just trying to get the story out onto the page. So I think most writers do not read critical work. But this book, I'm anxious to read it because I know that it's sort of covering the whole breadth of my work. And so I'm interested to see what these scholars think about that. And Sylvia Sherbet is certainly someone that I have high regard for. I've worked with her in the past at Shepherd University as a writer in residence there. And so I know what a wonderful reader and scholar that she is. So I know that it's going to be a good collection of work.
Do you experience a kind of a sense of arrival or a particular achievement knowing that your works are worthy of this kind of scrutiny?
That's a good question. I guess that it mainly just feels good to know that the work is being read. You know, for it to be written about means that it is being read. And that's really what you want as a published writer. You know, you want for your words to be shared with people. You want it to you want your words to move people or change them in some way for them to have some kind of emotional response. And so it feels like a validation, I guess, more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your work with Tiffany Williams. And by the way, I begged her for a sampling of your duet with her, but it hasn't been mixed yet, so she understandably and very politely declined. We'll just have to wait till it comes out later in the summer. But if you would, tell us what brought you to Duane Lundy's studio in Lexington to record that song with Tiffany.
Well, I have known Tiffany a long time, and I've always loved her work. I loved her music. And she just has such a unique voice. But the main thing that I love about her is her songwriting. She can do in 3 minutes, you know, what it takes me 300 pages of a novel to do. And I just think that's so amazing to have such emotional depth in such a short space. And in the past, we've been at gatherings and things of that nature and have sung a few songs together and found that we really feed off each other when we're singing together and have a good singing chemistry. And so when she asked me to sing on this album, I was very nervous about it because I'm not a professional singer. You know, I'm just a front porch singer or a living room singer. And I'm not somebody that feels totally comfortable even doing that. And so it's nerve-wracking for me because I just feel so inferior as a singer next to Tiffany. So I'm just depending on Duane Lundy, who's such a great producer, to make me sound good enough to sing alongside her.
Well, she certainly thinks very highly of your voice, and this song will no doubt be shared far and wide. And I'm just wondering, and I ask her this too, if you feel this kind of sense of representation of the region through this collaboration with a fellow Eastern Kentuckian who's a coal miner's daughter, granddaughter, and great-granddaughter.
I think that feeling of representation is stronger when you are doing a project with another Appalachian or another Eastern Kentuckian. So yeah, there is that element of it for sure. And I think that one thing that really I thought a lot about when we were recording the song is just our mutual love for country music. It is a country duet that we're doing. And I think that I really drew on that, on both of us growing up with such a deep reverence for the music of the region and both of us growing up sort of in a cradle where so many country music artists came out of, you know, and a place that has had so much influence on American music. And really, again, the song is so good that as I was singing, I just tried to inhabit that character because it is a very character-driven song.
Speaking of influences, what is your message, Silas, to other aspiring writers, poets, playwrights, singer-songwriters, all of which you are, about pursuing those passions as life's works?
Well, I think the main thing for me has been to tell the stories I want to hear, and to give voice to people who are often voiceless. That's been sort of the main thesis of my career, I think, is I've always gone back to that. I've always gone back to especially people in my family who had such rich stories to tell, but really were never given the opportunities to have those heard by a wider audience. And so I always, I just always feel lifted up by those ancestors, you know, and the people in my family who I grew up hearing telling stories, and the people who raised me to be really proud of where I'm from and to not let anyone treat me as an inferior because of where I was from. So for me, a big part of it is just honoring my people. I try to do that, but I also want to just tell my own truth. I think that's what all of us, you know, ultimately want to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a lot to look forward to. The book coming out in June. Tiffany tells me that she expects her album to come out in August. So it's going to be an interesting summer.
I can't wait either because I'm totally in the dark about how the song is going to sound and the book. So I'm looking forward to both of them.
That's Kentucky author Silas House, whose works are the focus of a collection of critical reviews in the forthcoming book, Silas House, Exploring an Appalachian Writer's Work. Thank you, Silas.
Thank you so much, Tom.
That song featuring the Tiffany Williams duet with Silas House is When I Come Back Around. We'll watch for its release and give you a heads up when it can be heard. Poetry found itself center stage on January 20th when 22-year-old Amanda Gorman, the nation's first National Youth Poet Laureate, stepped to the lectern during the inauguration of President Biden and Vice President Harris to recite her poem, The Hill We Climb. Amanda was still composing this poem on January 6th when rioters stormed Congress. She stayed awake late into the night and finished the composition after adding verses about the apocalyptic scene that she had witnessed unfolding at the Capitol that day.
Being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it. We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy. And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated.
From there, the work soared into crescendo.
If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left. With every breath from my bronze-pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the West. We will rise from the wind-swept Northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the Midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked South. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
National Youth Poet Laureate Amanda Gorman from her poem The Hill We Climb as she recited it during the recent inaugural ceremony on the Capitol steps in Washington. Well, the times have inspired poetry, as Tom Eblin learned in a conversation with one of Kentucky's best-known poets, Frank X. Walker.
The Danville native was a founder of the Afro-Latchian Poets Group. He even coined the term Afrolachian. And in 2013 and 2014, he was the first black person to serve as Kentucky's Poet Laureate. Walker has published a dozen books, has many poetry prizes, and he is now the director of the Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing at the University of Kentucky. He also is the publisher of Pluck, the new journal of African art and culture. Last year, as the world experienced a pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement, Walker was busy writing. The result is a terrific new book entitled Masked Man Black, Pandemic and Protest Poems, published by Accents Publishing. Walker's poems are at times angry, at times tender. They are always witty, thought-provoking, and incredibly timely. These poems explore the trauma of daily life we have all experienced with COVID-19 over the past year, as well as the trauma of daily life that African Americans have experienced for 400 years. Here with us to talk about the book and his work is poet Frank X. Walker. Frank, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Glad to be here. I'm a fan.
Well, tell us a little about the origins of this book.
Well, I think it really just started out as me trying to do my annual kind of homage to poetry by writing a poem a day during National Poetry Month in April, you know. But I made a decision this year because the news was so inundated with, you know, details about COVID-19, and there were new rules every day, and we were shut and sheltered inside, and everything was so brand new and strange. We couldn't talk about anything else. There was nothing else on the news. So I just made a decision to process what was happening in real time and write poems about the pandemic. But then after April was exhausted, you know, COVID was just, you know, getting the second wind.
Yeah.
So the poems kept coming, and somewhere in the middle of summer, the news stopped being about COVID and started being about the protests happening around the country because of what happened after the Blake lynching that was, you know, became viral really quickly, and the video was seen everywhere at once, it seems. And then it was like a two-headed thing, you know, the pandemic, the protests, and the news. So I was still writing a poem a day deep into July. And it was somewhere around that time that the publisher of Accents, you know, mentioned that she had been enjoying the poems and believed that there was enough there for a book if I was interested. And I immediately contacted her and said, yeah, let's do this. I hadn't thought about it as a book at the time, and, you know, it just forced me into it.
Yeah, I saw many of these first as Facebook posts, which was kind of a new way to distribute poetry.
Well, and it was a challenge for me, too, because, you know, my wife would rather I at least draft it 8 or 9 times before I share it with anybody else but her.
Mm-hmm.
But I put the extra pressure on myself of committing to releasing it on Facebook before noon every day. And I start writing, you know, before 6 a.m., so I didn't think that was a problem, you know, to get through at least 3 or 4 good edits before I released it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was, and also made a commitment not to read the responses. I just went on, posted it, and left, and then spent the rest of the day, you know, trying to help raise a 2-year-old.
Yeah.
it's hard to do both. My wife also was looking at them as a group of poems and editing them at the same time. In fact, she edited the whole collection and wrote an introduction.
Mm-hmm.
I would say between her and Katerina and, you know, my poems as rough as they were in the beginning. And we got them, I think, sharpened enough to feel comfortable releasing as a group of poems. So it's and thank you for, you know, believing this might be my best work. I know it happened in the quickest amount of time, but I worked really hard to do something I didn't think was possible. You know, I didn't know I could write a poem a day that many days in a row.
Yeah. Well, so how has your creative process been different this year?
Well, for me, I think because of the pandemic, and because I have more time at home, people would say I've been prolific. And nobody ever accused me of that before. You know, I think that since spring break of last year, mid-March of last year, I completed a draft of my novel, my first large fiction project. I finished a children's book, and I finished this book, and was writing so many other kinds of poems over the course of this time that I've had, I think I had over 50 poems accepted for publication this last year alone in journals and anthologies. But it's the most time I've had to spend, you know, I felt like a full-time writer, full-time poet.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really done that full-time. But, you know, what happened was, you know, teaching shifted to an online, option. Then I had the summer off immediately after that. So I really did have almost 5 or 6 months to really, really focus on poetry. I've never had that before, not that kind of, you know, uninterrupted time to be a writer.
Yeah.
So I wrote.
Well, what have you learned about yourself in the past year? You know, poets generally are kind of self-reflective people, but you can tell in a lot of these poems that are not only about COVID or the Black Lives Matter movement, but also just kind of daily life. So what did you learn about yourself?
Well, you know, I learned that I have a broad range of emotions, and that for me, it was a healthy way to process the things that I didn't understand or the things that made sense to me. And I think it felt good to share those with other people and then get their feedback. I mean, it's almost like the collection is a documentary, and not just about my life, but other people's experiences in real time. And I think it's easy to be reflective about something that happened in the past, but to keep doing it while it's happening right now, I don't know that it was a challenge I thought I could finish.
Yeah. Well, what kind of feedback have you gotten so far? You said you weren't reading them on Facebook, but I'm sure you've caught up to that now.
Well, just based on the submission and acceptance, you know, almost 25 of the poems were published before the book came out, and collections that came out as anthologies this fall or as journals over the course of the summer. 4 of those poems have been nominated for Pushcart prizes.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. And, you know, 4 different publications, not even one, you know, it's not like one person liked those poems. You know, that's never happened before. In fact, I've rarely gotten a Pushcart nomination over the years, but to get 4 in the same year from the same group of poems was kind of, you know, it made me grin.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like a confirmation, like people were listening and paying attention. And, you know, such as it is, I haven't had a chance to do any kind of real book tour. You know, I've done a lot of readings virtually, but it doesn't feel like a book tour because there's no interaction with the public afterwards and no signing books. So I've basically been giving books away since the book came out.
Yeah.
A lot of people got them as holiday presents and gifts. But there were a lot of readings, and I'm still getting invitations to read from that collection.
Mm-hmm.
Around the country now, starting to be bigger than Kentucky, you know, so I'm excited about that. You know, the book was also nominated for a couple of national prizes already.
Oh, good.
So it's doing some stuff in spite of the pandemic, and we'll see what happens.
What do you hope readers will take away from the book?
You know, I hope they take away at least that these poems document something that they also experienced. Even the more personal poems that deal with relationships, what it's like to live in the same space with somebody that you didn't really see that much before the shutdown. And now to be, you know, to use my brother's language, to be trapped in the same house with somebody.
Yeah.
But still find out that you love them, you know, dearly, is a great reward, you know. You know, I worry about those relationships that did not survive the you know, sheltered in place, that people found out that they really don't like each other enough to stay in the same space with each other that long.
Yeah.
And I also enjoyed rediscovering some things I take for granted that weren't that important to me, like gardening and just being outside and feeding birds and watching them eat. I hadn't done that in over 40 years. But to do it again and to feel and experience the stress release that comes from, you know, digging in dirt and managing a garden, even if it's just pulling weeds, and then the satisfaction of harvesting those crops and to feed yourself at your own dinner table. There's something about that process that made me feel closer to my parents and how they both, you know, both my parents grew up on farms.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their fathers were farmers. So I come from this long line of agricultural people that had kind of been cut off, you know, when I went off to go to college.
Yeah.
You know, I never really lived that experience that they always talked about growing up. But it was nice to feel closer to them in that tradition. But I have to give COVID the credit because I wouldn't have had that extra time at home, you know, trying to enjoy every square inch of property we have.
And it's not
a huge acreage, but I think I spent more time outdoors in my own yard since March than I did before.
Wow. Well, can you read us a selection from the book?
Sure. This one is, I think it speaks for itself. It's called I'm Being Sarcastic. And it's for my 2-year-old. Our 2-year-old grabbed the mic, pronounced his uneaten slice of watermelon a boat, and sailed it off his plate onto the dark blue sea table mat, becoming the after-dinner entertainment instead of the evening press conference. And as soon as we were all convinced he was right, he picked it up, smiled slyly, took 2 quick bites, and pronounced it a race car. I thought, my God, he could be president. As I imagined him in a big red tie instead of his signature bib, the second ever toddler to take a dump in the Oval Office. We all thought telling little white lies and dressing up like a clown was cute until the German kid opened up her real science kit. Our problem child makes unflyable paper planes out of the Constitution, uses fat crayons to color his talking points, pretends to know more than all the experts, and waits for the adults in the room to clean up his latest mess.
All right. Well, thank you. And once again, the book is Mass Man Black, Pandemic and Protest Poems, published by Accent Publishing of Lexington. Frank X. Walker, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Eblin author interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. On next week's edition, we'll feature yet another Kentucky writer, Bobby Kahn, whose debut memoir, In the Shadow of the Valley, has received rave reviews. She'll talk with us about an essay she wrote for Salon.com, responding to the recent Netflix debut of the film adaptation of the J.D. Vance memoir, Hillbilly Elegy. And NPR media critic Eric Deggans will be our guest to talk about his upcoming appearance in the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic or an interview? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.